A ceasefire proposal from the Russian Orthodox Church? Is this a real step towards peace or just propaganda?
The so-called Christmas ceasefire proposed by the head of the Russian Orthodox Church is a trap.
And the war in Ukraine's Donetsk region shows no signs of slowing down.
And it's war, and it's bloody, and it's vicious, and it has been over the last several weeks.
And later in the program, alternative sources of energy are important all over the world. However, they're probably more important in Ukraine, where traditional energy sources have largely been destroyed. We take a look at how some are adapting. Today is Thursday, January 5th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby called the fighting in Ukraine's Donetsk region bloody and vicious, as the Russian military's top brass came under increasing scrutiny over an attack that left at least 89 Russian soldiers and possibly many more dead.
The fighting there in the Donbas has been quite intense in recent weeks, and it's pretty clear to us, and certainly clear to the Ukrainians, that the Russians continue to flow manpower in to try to tip the balance there, particularly in the Donetsk area. And it's war, and it's bloody, and it's vicious, and it has been over the last several weeks.
The scene last weekend in the Russian-held town of Makiivka, where soldiers were temporarily stationed, appears to have been a recipe for disaster. Hundreds of Russian troops were reportedly clustered in a building close to the front lines and possibly next to an ammunition storage area, all well within range of Ukraine's Western-supplied precision artillery. Ukraine's armed forces claimed the Makiivka strike killed about 400 Russian soldiers. The Russians claim 89 deaths. It wasn't possible to verify either side's claims due to the fighting. It was one of the deadliest single attacks on the Kremlin's forces since the war began, and the highest death toll in a single incident acknowledged so far by either side in the conflict. The regiment's deputy commander was among the dead. The Makiivka strike last weekend seemed to be the latest blow to the Kremlin's military prestige as it struggles to advance the invasion of its neighbor amid a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive. As details of the strike have trickled out in recent days, some observers have accused military commanders' sloppiness at the root of so many deaths. Many Russian pro-military and nationalist commentators are especially critical of the military's performance. UK intelligence officials said Wednesday that Moscow's unprofessional military practices were likely partly to blame for the high casualties. The Russian Defense Ministry, in a rare admission of losses, initially said the strike killed 63 troops, but as emergency crews searched the ruins, the death toll mounted. Kirby says he sees no signs of hostilities slowing down.
Though winter is upon us, the fighting has not stopped, and the fighting in the east has been particularly intense in the last several weeks, and I think we need to expect that that kind of fighting will continue for quite some time.
Meanwhile, away from the battlefields, France said Wednesday it will send French-made AMX-10 RC light tanks to Ukraine, a first from a Western European country, following an afternoon phone call Wednesday between French President Emmanuel Macron and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
France brings a new level of European defense support to Ukraine, and I thank President Macron for this leadership. We will get more armored vehicles, including French-made wheeled tanks. This is what gives a clear signal to all our other partners. There is no rational reason why Western-style tanks have not yet been supplied to Ukraine. And this is very important in order to restore security for all Ukrainians and peace for all Europeans.
The French have not said how many tanks would be delivered and when. France has previously given Ukraine anti-tank and air defense missiles, as well as rocket launchers. We'll find out about a ceasefire proposal from the head of the Russian Orthodox Church in Kyiv in a few minutes. First, though, in an effort to bolster their own defenses, Poland, Russia's neighbor to the west and Ukraine's neighbor to the north, is buying tanks from the U.S. Karen Chamas has the story.
Poland's defense minister has signed a deal to buy a second batch of U.S. tanks as the country beefs up its defense capabilities in light of Russia's war in neighboring Ukraine. As Warsaw strengthens its military cooperation with Washington, officials announced that Poland is the first U.S. ally in Europe to be receiving Abrams tanks. Poland's defense minister, Mariusz Błaszczak, signed the $1.4 billion deal at a military base near Warsaw. The agreement foresees the delivery of 116 Abrams tanks starting this year. This adds to another deal made last year for 250 upgraded tanks that will be delivered in 2025-26. Polish and U.S. officials said the deal strengthened Poland, the region, and NATO's eastern flank as the war in Ukraine continues. I'm Karen Chamas.
After scores of Russian soldiers were killed by a Ukrainian attack in Makiivka, there's been blame pointed in every direction. Here to help me sort through it all is Carolina Hurd, a Russia analyst from the Institute for the Study of War. We begin by discussing the Makiivka attack. The Russians are now saying 89 dead. The Ukrainians are saying closer to 400 dead. Who's right?
So it's quite difficult to tell in the open source the death counts for these sort of attacks. We can say with confidence that the Russian MOD does not have a good track record of being upfront and transparent with data for killed or wounded in action.
So that's Ministry of Defense?
Yes, the Russian Ministry of Defense. So with you know, a fair amount of confidence, we can say that they're probably lowballing the number. But it's hard to also confirm the Ukrainian counts. I know that the U.S. is counting somewhere in the middle. So it's probably somewhere in the hundreds, but we're not going to be able to say in the open source. We don't have that sort of exact information.
The Russians are also saying that one of the causes of this attack was their troops using cell phones when they weren't supposed to be, and that allowed Ukrainian forces to zero in on their location. We've had Ukrainian reporters on this program say that, in fact, that's not entirely true because Ukrainian intelligence services have been following and tracking those Russian troops for weeks and knew exactly where they were. Again, who's right?
So this is a really, really interesting issue because it's evident that cell phones did play some sort of role, right? There were hundreds of servicemen there. Their cell phones lit up right after Putin's New Year's Eve speech. And that does provide data that makes them a target. However, in any professionally organized, adequately trained army, there would not have been that sort of concentration of personnel within Ukrainian artillery range. So there was huge command failures that led up to the point where there were that many people in one location so close to the front line. So yes, Ukrainian intelligence likely was tracking them for longer. Cell phones played a role, undoubtedly, but it really comes down to pervasive command failures and just like mishandling of mobilized servicemen.
So you mentioned the pervasive command failures, systemic failures, you say in your report. There are commentators, bloggers in Russia who are being extremely critical of the Russian military for what happened. What are they saying?
So the mill bloggers really seized on this strike, and specifically the Russian Ministry of Defense response to the strike that basically straight out blamed personal cell phone usage for the strike. And they seized on this attempt to attribute blame to the individual servicemen as a way to criticize the Russian MOD's continued mishandling of the war. And we've seen just this rage coming out of the pro-war mill bloggers, basically saying, how dare you blame these servicemen? It's not their fault. They should have never been in this situation in the first place. And we've seen incidences like this that there's been some sort of systemic issue that has resulted in large loss of life for the Russians, and mill bloggers seizing on that opportunity to launch very, very specific critiques, very scathing critiques at the Russian just wartime apparatus in general.
So what's interesting here is that We've seen a lot of Russian opposition leaders end up kicked out of the country, escaping the country, or flat out assassinated or put in jail. How is it that these bloggers are operating with such impunity?
So this is also a very interesting point, because there are divisions in the Russian domestic information space that tracks on to the rise in milbloggers' prominence. So many of the milbloggers are very, very critical specifically of the institution that is the Russian Ministry of Defense. And Putin, throughout the course of the war, has been scapegoating the Russian Ministry of Defense and kind of distancing himself and those who he aligns with ideologically against the Russian Ministry of Defense. So a lot of times when the majority of the Russian milbloggers, they're very aligned with Putin and Putin's kind of conduct of the war, and very critical of the Russian Ministry of Defense. So they kind of play into Putin's desire to set himself apart from the institution that is the Russian Ministry of Defense, which is why they've been allowed to kind of operate, as you say, with this degree of impunity.
Ukraine's spy chief has been saying to expect a large Ukrainian counteroffensive in the spring.
Yes. So Budanov has been using his platform in the last month or so to basically speak on Ukrainian goals. And it's an interesting choice for sure. However, his description of this planned Ukrainian counteroffensive that will take place in the spring is pretty consistent with our forecasts on the way that we think that Ukrainians are going to launch a series of subsequent counteroffensives into the early months of 2023 in order to be able to retain the initiative that they currently have on the back end of their successful counteroffensive in Kharkiv and Kherson Oblast, and maintain that initiative and regain territory. So Budanov's statements are likely consistent with the forecast we've been making about what the early months of this year is going to look like. And we try not to speculate in too much detail about why he's doing what he's doing. But yes, that's where we stand on that.
Bakhmut still seems to be where the heaviest fighting is. What's going on there?
There's been a lot of concentration in the media about, well, it seems like Russians are continuing to push really hard for this. What's going to happen? And it's very clear to me that the offensive around Bakhmut is likely culminating, despite the fact that there continue to be offensive pushes on the tactical level by specifically Wagner Group forces. So we've seen continued claims of gains to the south of Bakhmut, to the northeast of Bakhmut around Soledad. But these sort of claims of gains are not inconsistent with the idea that the offensive is culminating. Culmination means that Russian forces will not be able to make operationally significant gains. So any sort of tactical success they might have around Bakhmut, even if it seems to be intensifying, does not necessarily mean that they're going to take Bakhmut in the foreseeable future. It's still very likely that this offensive is in the process of or in the direction of culmination.
Carolina Hurd, a Russia analyst with the Institute for the Study of War. Ms. Hurd, thank you for your analysis today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday ordered a 36-hour ceasefire in Ukraine over Orthodox Christmas after an appeal from the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, a step Ukraine has dismissed as a cynical trap. Putin ordered the 36-hour ceasefire to begin at 12 o'clock on January 6, the Kremlin said. Many Orthodox Christians, including those living in Russia and Ukraine, celebrate Christmas on January 6 and 7. Patriarch Kirill of Moscow called earlier on Thursday for both sides of the war in Ukraine to observe a Christmas truce. In his statement, Putin said, "Proceeding from the fact that a large number of citizens professing Orthodoxy live in the areas of hostilities, we call on the Ukrainian side to declare a ceasefire and allow them to attend services on Christmas Eve as well as on Christmas Day." Ukraine earlier dismissed Kirill's appeal, though there was no immediate reaction to Putin's ceasefire announcement. A senior aide to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Mykhailo Podolyak, cast the Russian Orthodox Church as a war propagandist that had incited the mass murder of Ukrainians and the militarization of Russia. The statement from the Russian Orthodox Church about the Christmas truce is a cynical trap and an element of propaganda, he said. A look at some innovations in alternative energy sources for Ukrainians coming soon. First, what's the reaction to the church's ceasefire proposal in Kyiv? We turn to Anna Chernikova, our reporter in Kyiv, for answers and updates.
Yeah, so basically, it was a proposal from the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, who is known as a good friend of President Putin. And he proposed, well, a ceasefire for Christmas Day, for Christmas period. And just around 20 minutes ago, it was an information from the Russian media that President Putin told to the Minister of Defense of Russia to actually start a ceasefire from noon on the 6th of January until midnight of the 7th of January. What I can say from the reaction from Kyiv, it was not taken seriously. We have a reaction from Mykhailo Podolak, who is an advisor to the head of the president's office, to Mr. Zelensky's office, and he said that the so-called Christmas ceasefire proposed by the head of the Russian Orthodox Church is a trap. He called this a cynical trap, and it was his post on Twitter, and his direct speech sounded like that the Russian Orthodox Church statement about the Christmas ceasefire is a cynical trap and an element of propaganda. And Ukrainians are not getting ready for any ceasefire. Ukrainians are getting ready for intensifying of the fighting because Russia is very well known for their love for, you know, big dates and especially religious dates. And usually during such big holidays like Eastern holidays, for instance, or Christmas holidays, fires and attacks increase. And this happened last Easter, actually. So this is basically the reaction.
So one of the things you've told us in the past is that the Ukrainian security services have found a lot of collaborators within the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. And you told us last month about many Ukrainians splitting with the church over when to celebrate Christmas. What makes Kirill think that he has any legitimacy, any sway with the Ukrainian public?
Well, I personally don't really think that this message was, message was directed to Ukrainians. I think this is more, more a message for Russian society, like to show that, well, Russian church is supporting peace and so on and so forth. But as we know, and also this is what Mr. Podolak mentioned, that that actually Russia Church supports this so-called special military operation by Russia, by President Putin, and it was also a direct announcement and direct report from the same Patriarch Kirill about all this, you know, main messages of Russian propaganda about protection of Russian-speaking people and so on and so forth. So I honestly think that this is not a message for Ukrainians. This is a message just, you know, in general to make certain, you know, idea and certain image of Russian church as they willing peace. But to be honest, this is not something that Ukrainians would trust to.
Now, you sent me a message earlier today saying you have news of a special event coming up on January 7th. Are you able to tell us what that is?
Yes, actually today it was confirmed that one of the main Ukrainian religious and cultural institutions, which is also UNESCO heritage, and this is Kyiv Печерська Лавра, is basically getting back under Ukrainian church control. So what happened is that for decades this place was used and basically occupied by Russian church representatives in Ukraine, and this place was unfortunately famous for for a lot of Russian pro-Russian activities and corruption within this church, and with especially connecting to the heads of this church. And at the end of last year, in December 2022, the main part of this Lavra complex, because it's a big cultural complex, was officially returned to the Ukrainian church. And the decision regarding the remain Lavra facilities is to be taken this year in 2023. And what is important that on January 7th, and it was already confirmed and announced by the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that the head of the Ukrainian Church will conduct the first service in the main cathedral of the Lavra complex. So this would be on the 7th of January. It's Christmas according to this old calendar. And this is a truly historic and remarkable event for Ukraine, and a lot of Ukrainians within the Ukrainian society are very happy about this. And this is kind of a, you know, serious step towards, this activities against Russian church operation in Ukraine, and decrease of Russian church influence in Ukraine.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
When Russian rockets start targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure and electrical grid, scientists in the city of Sumy, near Kyiv, are hoping to start mass-producing solar technology that could keep the lights on. Olena Adamenko has the story, narrated for us today by Anna Rice.
Since the start of Russia's invasion, scientists from the city of Sumy have been working on developing alternative energy sources, a must since Russia's war in Ukraine has destroyed so much of the country's energy infrastructure. Residents are hoping scientists can help.
My neighbors love what we're doing. They say we'll be fine as long as Alexei is near.
Sumy resident Alexey Drezdenko gets and shares energy thanks to solar panels installed on top of his roof.
We call garages that deal with destroyed electric vehicles in Kyiv, Kharkiv, and ask them to sell us rechargeable batteries that are still functional. We hope to provide three or four houses with electricity for about 10 hours daily as a result, fully autonomous.
Drezdenko is the deputy head of the computer science department at the Sumy State University and says his team at the university invented the portable solar array. Each power trailer costs less than $4,000. They are being mass-produced in parts of Ukraine, including in Vinnytsia and Volyn region.
We can provide any checkpoint, field hospital or command post with energy in an area where there is no electricity. One person can unpack it and pack it back up in 5-7 minutes.
This makeshift power station consists of six solar panels, as well as batteries from simple trucks. The trailers not only collect energy and store it, they also convert it into a usable power source.
The third element is an inverter, which makes sure that batteries are working properly and allows us to add other power sources, like generators.
Drezdenko says Sumy residents are installing solar panels.
I've seen several people install solar panels in their homes, on their roofs, in lobbies, and find ways to connect them to batteries. So it's a step towards being fully autonomous.
Sumy engineers are also working to improve the solar panels themselves, using new materials that could make them cheaper and safer for the environment. For Alena Adamenko in Sumy, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.